I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. In the summer of 1967, radio listeners heard this song written by an unknown singer named Bobby Gentry.
It was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. And then she said, I got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today, Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
Ode to Billy Joe became an immediate hit and made Gentry famous. There was even a movie made based on the song. Bobby Gentry made numerous TV appearances, had her own TV show, and developed an elaborate stage show in Las Vegas. And then, in the mid-1970s, she hung it all up and has made no more public appearances since. Our guest, Tara Murther, has written a book about the elusive Bobby Gentry and the enigmatic lyrics in Ode to Billy Joe. It's part of the 33 and a third series called Ode to Billy Joe. And she is a journalist who is focused on news, crime, policy, and justice issues here in Philadelphia. She's an Ochberg Fellow at Columbia University's Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma. And Tara Murther, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back.
I found out you were not even alive in 1967 when this song came out.
I did not hear it when it came out.
So what got you started on this trail?
Well, initially I heard the song, I might have heard it before, but I didn't have really a strong awareness of it until my husband, when we were dating and we were in that mixtape exchanging phase of the relationship, and he turned me on to the record, sort of surprised, you know, that I didn't know about it already. And I got really into it and started looking her up online, and then when I saw videos and how just amazing of a performer she was and super sexy, and she sort of seemed like if she didn't exist, we would have needed to make her up, you know, very, you know, an archetype almost. And then I found out she disappeared, and I sort of went down the rabbit hole from there. Yeah.
And the song, the first time you heard it was when your boyfriend gave you a mixtape?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I might have heard it. It seems like it's sort of in the DNA of American consciousness sort of thing. But the first time that I really sort of registered it, and certainly the rest of the album, was when he gave it to me.
Well, I was about 17 or 18 years old in 1960. I can't do the math quickly here. But this was the summer between high school and college. Mm. And I remember hearing it and doing a little research. It knocked the Beatles off the top of the charts there that summer.
It came out of nowhere. It was a single, so it was the 45 was Ode to Billy Joe on one side and Mississippi Delta on the other. No one knew what Bobby Gentry looked like. She was a total unknown, so a lot of people thought she was a black singer. That led the Ode to Billy Joe going on all different charts instead of getting categorized as country right away. It was on the country and soul charts. So it knocked All You Need Is Love, the, you know, unknown girl from nowhere knocked the Beatles off. Yeah.
And the lyrics, I mean, there are those questions. What did they throw off the bridge? Why did he commit suicide? Were those also questions you were looking to try to figure out answers to?
Yeah, I mean, from the beginning, Bobby Gentry always said and always maintained that what was thrown off the bridge wasn't important, there wasn't a real answer there, that the real point was to point to how people have a really hard time understanding what other people are going through. The family around the dinner table doesn't get what the girl is going through when they deliver the news that Billy Joe jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. So I didn't think that there would be a solution to that per se. I was more interested in tethering the mystery of the song to the mystery of the singer. It's pretty interesting that somebody known for this very, very mysterious song then became one of rock and roll's biggest mysteries herself.
And when it was on, I guess it was on the Smothers Brothers show, in the background, I mean, it's just the weirdest looking thing. In the background, she's singing in the foreground. Mm-hmm. In the background is a table with three
mannequins.
Yeah,
sitting around. And these are the. This is this family that seems to be very uninterested in the fact that Billy Joe jumped off.
Yeah,
the
they're made of plaster and sort of chiseled really roughly. And that is the Smothers Brothers show. And that's the one that Jill Soulbuehl wrote the intro to the book. She saw that as a kid, and that inspired her to pick up guitar. You know, but very, very creepy. The song itself is creepy, and they went all in on the Smothers Brothers, on the creep factor.
I'm curious about her family, and she grew up a little bit in Mississippi, but tell us a little bit about Bobby Gentry's family life.
Yeah, so she was born in Chickasaw County, and she was raised on her grandparents' farm there until she was about six. Her parents had split up pretty shortly after she was born, and her mom left. I'm not sure if she went right to California at that point, but she wound up in California. And at 6 years old, she left her grandparents' farm and then moved 50 miles to the Delta region. So the Delta imagery is what she's most known for. That's where Choctaw Ridge was. That's where the Tallahatchie Bridge is. And she stayed there until about 13. And then she moved to California and joined her mother, who had since remarried. And then her life in California was completely different. Right. I mean, the farm had no electricity, whereas in California she took horseback riding lessons and art lessons and studied music and started playing as a duo with her mom at the country club. So it was a totally different life. But that part of her life was obscured when she hit it big. She was reframed as the Mississippi gal.
Yeah, exactly. Although it's interesting that I guess for a while she lived with her father and stepmother and did write a song about a mean stepmother. I don't know.
She did.
You know, how autobiographical that was.
Right. Well, that's the question. She does. She writes very starkly, kind of obviously autobiographical songs mixed in with she's a character writer. You know, she writes lots of characters, mostly female characters, and all of them have this thing in common. You know, one of them's a stripper in Texas, you know, another one's working on the factory line, dreaming of dancing how she used to. So all of her female characters, including her, you know, they're all struggling for freedom and intimacy and trying to, it's sort of a paradox of how to get those two things at the same time.
Which seems like very contemporary issues for that time.
Yeah.
Especially for women.
Totally contemporary issues. And same thing when she's interviewed, she's accused of contemporary paradoxes like how can you be a feminist and, you know, wear a push-up bra, you know, dance on stage and appeal to men and that kind of thing.
Well, you pulled out a couple of headlines that were when she sort of hopped on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
One of the headlines, or one of the writers said when Bobby Gentry's song became so famous, 23-year-old Bobby Gentry is anything but the hillbilly folk singer you might expect. If she didn't have a Miss America type figure, 37, 23, 37, you might call her an intellectual.
Yeah, that's my favorite one. that's my favorite one because it's so obviously ridiculous and absurd. But she was well aware of those things. She didn't want to be a performer in the beginning. She wanted to be the composer and songwriter, and she's all of those things, of course. But at the time, you needed to really kind of choose, especially female singers were interpreters. They were singers. They were the pretty faces on stage. They weren't behind, behind the controls. So she initially, you know, just performed for cash and connections and fun. And when she tried to sell Ode to Billy Joe to Capitol and they got a load of her, they were like, we're putting you on stage, girlfriend. Sorry.
Well, I want to play Mississippi Delta. And this is the flip side of Ode to Billy Joe. And this was the song that was thought to be if there was going to be a hit, that this would be the hit song more than Ode to Billy Joe. This is Mississippi Delta by Bobby Gentry, and it's the first track on the album Ode to Billy Joe, 1967, the B-side, and originally the A-side. Let's give it a listen.
Riding the middle of the cotton belt down in the Mississippi Delta.
That's Bobby Gentry singing Mississippi Delta. The B-side, it was supposed to be the A-side, became the B-side of her hit song Ode to Billy Joe, or hit record, I should say. And these guests were 45s originally, right?
Yeah, it was originally a 45. And it's remarkable that, you know, you can't help but notice how different Mississippi Delta sounds than Ode. Mississippi Delta was the song she was trying to sell the Capitol, because that's what was burning up the charts in 1967. You know, Ode was the one, the outlier. That's the one that sounds different than anything else. So she got in the door with Mississippi Delta, and she got in with the door with it completely produced. I mean, Mississippi Delta is as much of a mystery as Ode to Billy Joe.
Oh,
nobody knows who those session players are.
I was just going to ask you, who's playing?
Yeah, I mean, Capitol bought the master that she brought, that's referred to as the demo, and it's never been discussed before. It's always just been sort of, you know, inferred that it was created at Capitol, but it wasn't. It was bought by Capitol. I couldn't find any studio records from Mississippi Delta. But she brought that in because that makes sense. That's what was a hit, and she was looking for a hit, you know. And they asked her if she had any more regional material for the other side. And
regional.
She said, yeah, I think that I do. So she brought in Ode. And then the producer, Kelly Gordon, flipped for Ode.
Just flipped like that the first time he heard
just
it?
Just flipped for it, yeah. And called up the there's a whole story where he went to his boss, David Axelrod, and the vice president of Capitol didn't want Ode because he was convinced it was about an abortion, that it was a fetus being thrown off the bridge, and he was a religious guy. So there's a whole sort of rigmarole there where David Axelrod went sort of above him and called up the publisher. $10,000, done deal. He just said, you can have it, the publisher, Larry Shane, as long as you don't put a rhythm section on it. Just don't put a rhythm section on it. And he said nothing about strings. So Kelly Gordon called up Jimmy Haskell and put those beautiful strings on top. And
wow.
So the final product of Ode is the, quote, demo, which is really a master with Bobby Gentry's vocal and guitar track that she brought in with Jimmy Haskell's strings on top and recorded in what they call a sweetening session at Capitol.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, back to some music as well. And our guest is Tara Murtha. She's a journalist based here in Philadelphia and has written a book, part of the 33 and a Third series called Ode to Billy Joe. And we played a selection or a section from the very beginning of that song. Also just played Mississippi Delta, the flip side of Ode to Billy Joe. This goes back to the summer of 1967. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Open up the lines, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We want any of your memories of this song or any theories about the song as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. If you're just joining us, Tara Murtha is our guest, and she has explored the life and career of the enigmatic and elusive Bobby Gentry in her book for the 33 and a Third series called Ode to Billy Joe. That would be Bobby Gentry's hit first song. And again, we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. In the meantime, let's listen to Diana Ross and the Supremes' 1968 cover of Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry.
It was the 3rd of June, another sleepy, dusty Delta day. I was out chopping cotton and my brother was baling hay. And at dinner time we stopped and we walked back to the house to eat. And Mama hollered at the back door, y'all remember to wipe your feet. Then she said she got some news this morning from Choctaw Ridge. Today, Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
Wow. want to miss Diana Ross and the Supremes. Then that's Diana Ross and the Supremes version of Ode to Billy Joe, and that came out in 1968. As you said, this was a record that sort of showed up on the country charts. It showed up on black music radio, black radio stations as well. So I guess that explains why a number of African-American artists have covered this song.
Yeah, I mean, like I think I mentioned that you know, a lot of listeners thought that Bobby Gentry was a black woman singing because there was no art that came out with the single. I interviewed Don Zimmerman, who went on to become the CEO of Capitol, but at the time he was a field marketing guy, and his job was to drive around California with records and bring it to DJs. And, you know, he told me the programmers would ask him, you know, so that they knew how to classify, because they classified music, especially Southern music, it'd be blues or country, according to skin color. And without having an answer, it just went up all the charts.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, you tried, like others have, to try to talk to or contact Bobby Gentry. Tell us all the things you tried to do.
Well, to correct, she actually performed through the 70s and sort of vanished a bit. I mean, that sounds like a dramatic word, but faded out, I guess, in the early 80s. The last documentation I found of a scheduled appearance was in 1983, and she canceled that appearance. And Bobby Gentry did not cancel. She worked through anything, you know, two shows a day for a decade. So so that was the last bit that was a public appearance. So I communicated with her through an intermediary. She graciously declined to be interviewed. You know, I was given the sort of relayed the sense that she really thought about it. And then in the end, her interest in privacy won out, is how it was phrased to me, which, you know, I respect.
Sure.
So, you know, and then I, as I say in the book, I thought about it and I was all giddy for a few days thinking, well, at least I, you know, communicated with her and somewhat feel like I got a blessing for the project. You know, and then I realized, I thought of all these other people I interviewed who told me a similar pattern where they even had an interview set up and then it was canceled, you know.
So politely declined.
I was like, she is Southern to the bone, you know, makes you feel good about a no.
Do you know, does anyone know where she lives or
anything
about her?
Oh, sure. I mean, a few, you know, it's a very small inner circle, and calling her old colleagues and friends, what was really surprising to me was no one was super surprised that she dropped out of sight, yet they were surprised that she was so out of sight that they were no longer in her inner circle, you know, so it was sort of a double-edged sword that way. And I would call people asking them, of course, for any scrap of memory that they have of working with her. And meanwhile, you know, they would interrupt my question to say, you know, do you know where she is? And can you please tell her that I said hello? And, you know, it's almost sad, you know. These people who really care, obviously love her and care a lot about her and hope that she's doing well.
Well, I have to say, something that I learned in reading your book is just what an accomplished businesswoman she was. I mean, this was a time when musicians were getting ripped off all the time.
Sure.
And she made sure that she made money and that she was in control. Help us understand, I guess, the degree to which she exerted control over her music.
Yeah, well, she was way ahead of her time. You know, especially marginalized artists would get ripped off left and right. You know, it's been theorized. She worked early on with Jody Reynolds. Her recording debut was with the rockabilly legend Jody Reynolds in 63. She did a couple duets. I mean, they didn't go anywhere, but that was her. And he had gotten ripped off by his publishing company. There was actually a fake name was made up that was given co-writing credit on his. Yeah, so it's been theorized through mutual acquaintances that maybe she got that lesson early on from the beginning from him. But wherever she got it, she, within months of Ode hitting, she set up her own, you know, production company, set up her own publishing company. To give you an idea, in 76, when they made the film Ode to Billy Joe based on the song, of course, the soundtrack's going to have Ode to Billy Joe on it. Instead of having Capitol, which was no longer affiliated with releasing the single again, she re-recorded it note for note for Warner Brothers, who distributed the movie, to give, you know, so that she had a bigger cut from
sure.
that. So she was just very savvy. And even beyond music, she was an investor. She invested in the Phoenix Suns basketball team with Henry Mancini and Andy Williams in 68. You know, she was building sustainable wealth the entire time.
I mean,
sure.
It sounds like she would do a contract and then rewrite it. I mean, if things change, then she would rewrite the contract to her benefit.
Yeah, and talking about contracts, she didn't have a contract when the song hit. So the song hit in July of 67. She was sent out on a big junket. That was her first time in New York, and she was the toast of the town, and she came to Philly.
She did.
You know, Jerry Geeter worked with her, of course.
Geeter the Heater, yeah.
Of course, and the DJ Highlight and stuff. And she sat in Danny's Hideaway in New York with the biggest star in the country, and she would not sign a contract for longer than 6 months. She signed a contract on a napkin with Jess Rand, who was best known for working with Sam Cooke and Sammy Davis Jr., got back to California, and before those 6 months were up, he told me that a lawyer showed up, a couple suitcases, and said she wants out before the end of the 6 months, and had shopped around to get what she wanted. So she was nobody's fool, and I think that's part of the issue with getting the production credit on Ode. I don't think it's a coincidence that her last record for Capitol, called Patchwork, in 1971, was the first one that she had full producer credit on.
Then the idea was to be the performer, but also be controlling things from behind the scenes.
Yes, she really wanted to do. But if it was one or the other, she'd rather be behind the scenes. But she wanted to do both. Yeah,
you're right. Bobby Gentry was one of the first female musicians to write, perform, and produce her own material. As you just said, she became the first woman to host her own variety show on the BBC. She DJed a popular radio program on Armed Forces Radio that aired all over the world. And as you said, she established these publishing companies. And again, just the sort of degree to which she was in control of her career.
Yeah, in control and looking out for other women. Some of the female old colleagues that I interviewed who didn't really want to go on record or get into it, you know, out of allegiance, they did want to make sure, said, you know, I don't want to talk to you for your book, but I want you to know that she looked out for other women in the industry coming up and was really interested in helping, helping women that she worked with get where they wanted to be.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Bobby Gentry. We're talking about the song Ode to Billy Joe. And again, our guest is Tara Murtha, who has written a book and part of the 33 and a third series Ode to Billy Joe. And it's about tracking down how this song got made and the people involved in it and Bobby Gentry herself. Looks like we have a lot of people that want to say something. I'm looking between two computers here. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Christina from Moorestown to join us. Christina, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Very well. I was just talking to, one of your producers or whoever it was.
Producer.
I was saying that on Mississippi Delta, that sounded very much like Creedence. I don't know if they were already pretty famous at that point or if they were doing any backup. I don't know. But then when I was about 12, I mean, the song was still played, and it was probably the early to mid-70s, somewhere around there. And I read the book that was based on the movie that was based on the song. It was like a Scholastic book at the time.
Uh-huh.
And they were talking about the reason Billy Joe McAllister jumps off the bridge is because he'd gotten drunk once and had a homosexual experience. Mm-hmm. And I guess this was a reason to kill yourself in Mississippi Delta whenever this was supposedly taking place. And I was like, oh, my God. You know, at the time, there's a girl who's the you know, I guess the Bobby Gentry, the singer voice.
Yes.
You know, but in the book, they have to stretch it out. And everybody thought that she had messed around with Billy Joe that night. So she leaves in order to make it look like she's going away to have a baby or something. I never understood quite how they twisted that around.
Well, Christina, let me see. We do have actually a clip from the movie, but let me give Tara just a chance to weigh in on your comment.
Well, yeah, your recollection is correct. The film that was made in 1976, the screenplay was written by a man named Henry Rauscher, and he wrote the novelization as well. And it was promised what the tagline for the movie was, what the song didn't tell you, the movie will. And that was the reason given. It was a little bit left, a little blurry in the visuals, but it's explicit in the book. And I interviewed the author, And he told me succinctly that it is the author's prerogative to sometimes be insane. And he maintains that Bobby—
To sometimes be insane?
Yeah. And he maintains that that was his creative decision and that Bobby Gentry did not tell him that she gave him creative rein. And that jives with what everybody else has said about her not being, you know, a micromanager that way. But and that was his idea. He wrote Summer of 42, which was transgressive because it features a young boy who has an affair with an older woman. And he knew that he wanted to do something with gay material later. And then I write about that at length in the book, the reaction of young queer Mississippians who had seen that film. And like the caller is saying, on one hand, saying, well, great, like he killed himself. You know, what kind of role model is that? And on the other hand, people being feeling validated for even having anybody that, you know, reflects their reality on the screen for the first time. Well, that's a dual answer there.
Indeed. Let me play a clip from this film, the 1976 film Ode to Billy Joe. And it features Robbie Benson and Glynis O'Connor. And this is the scene that that sort of speaks to what happened at the bridge.
Oh, it's all right, Billy Joe.
It ain't all right. I ain't all right. Bobby, I have been with a man. Did you hear me? Which is a sin against nature. A sin against God. I don't know how I could have done it. I swear. I don't know how I could be wanting you and do that.
But you were drunk. Maybe you just imagined it.
I didn't imagine nothing.
And again, a scene from the movie version of Ode to Billy Joe. And I find it interesting that Bobby Gentry would allow another writer to sort of run with this idea to her song. I mean, there's so many other ways you could interpret what might have happened on the bridge, but to have someone do this one, I realize this is back in 1976, but nonetheless.
Well, certainly she must have condoned it. I don't think she didn't just kind of disavow having anything to do with it. But she had a huge gay following. She had a very like Bette Midler-like gay following. She was very transgressive when it came to gender in general. In Vegas, her most famous performance is her doing a tribute to Elvis. And she does the DA and the dangling split curl and the whole thing, you know. And she did an Andrew Sisters number where two of her male dancers dressed up in the you know, girl nurses' uniforms. And so she was very – and had a lot of intimate, you know, gay friends. And so she was very transgressive that way. So I'm sure that she – I mean, she definitely approved it happened, you know. But the author suggested it was his idea.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking Roger Ebert said in his review.
Oh, yeah. What did he say?
You know, now that I found out why Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge, you know, I wish that I didn't know. But fans generally kind of rejected that as an explanation and continue to ask, you know, what was thrown off the bridge.
Let me get Alan from looks like Wincote to join our conversation. Hi, Alan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I, interestingly, were just on a road trip through Mississippi and were startled to find ourselves crossing the Tallahatchie Bridge. And we didn't realize, of course, there are probably many bridges across the river, but we didn't realize that at the time that the association with the river includes the murder of Emmett Till back in 1955. That's where his body was discovered. I don't know if your listeners are aware of that history or, you know, I haven't had the benefit of reading the book either. But also, we happened to be listening to the killer version of the song by Patricia Barber as we were crossing the bridge.
Oh, really?
So
wow.
It was. I'm sure your guest must be aware of that one.
But, oh, she is. Absolutely. It's in the book, Alan. No, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Tara, you want to add to that?
Well, certainly I mentioned the Emmett Till murder, and that did lend to some of the theories when it came out that perhaps it was commenting on racial relations. Right. You know, and then some of the other theories had to do with gender, again, because of Billy Joe being spelled the girl way. But
I-E, right?
B-I-L-L-I-E. But the movie is B-I-L-L-Y. And it turns out that, you know, to dismantle anyone's theories on the gender one, it was just Capital rushed it out so quick that they misspelled it. She spelled it with a Y. So then it just stayed the I-E, you know.
Just to add to the mystery, right? Mm-hmm. We have a tweet from Cindy. I think of that song every hot, muggy summer. I saw the movie and was disappointed. Were you disappointed in the movie?
No, I wouldn't say that I was disappointed in the movie, but by the time I was coming to it, I was coming to it from a very analytical point of view, so it's kind of hard to say, not of the era, right. You know? I mean, I watched the movie last year.
Is that
it wasn't
right?
available on DVD for years and years because the producers couldn't get in touch with her to get the permissions. You know, that was one of the reasons why it was delayed so long.
We were watching earlier today her performance, or I guess an excerpt of one of her performances in Las Vegas. Mm. And I mean, talk about pulling out the stops with the smoke machines and the dancers and the.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, you know, it's completely Las Vegas.
Yeah, she had, and that reflects her musical sensibility too. She has had a very kitchen sink style, you know, very Baroque, and that's. Another reason, I mean, Ode was an exception to her rule in Sarah's style goes. It wasn't really her rule. That little rhythm kind of threads throughout everything, but usually it's much more trumped up and bombastic. And, you know, she was known for having the most wild Vegas shows, you know, where she'd descend from the sky and there was rain and there was, you know, horses on stage. It was like a whole, you know, chaotic kind of show. She liked very elaborate choreography. And special effects.
And I can imagine it was a big hit in Las Vegas.
She was huge in Las Vegas. She pretty much replicated what she did in the music industry in Vegas, and she became the highest paid performer in Vegas. She sang at the Vegas award shows, doing the opening number. She negotiated her own deals, according to her choreographer, which was, again, totally unheard of in general, never mind for a female performer. I think an anecdote that didn't make the book was her choreographer, Donald Bradburn, sitting with her, and, you know, she's talking to these kind of mafia kind of guys, you know, with their guns out and signing contracts, and he was like, weren't you intimidated by that? She just laughed, you know. No. She didn't seem to be intimidated by much of anything.
We'll take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Tara Murtha about Bobby Gentry and the song Ode to Billy Joe. Part of the 33 and a third series of books. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, again talking with Tara Murtha. She's a Philadelphia-based journalist, also an Ochberg Fellow at Columbia University's Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma. And we've been talking about Ode to Billy Joe. In fact, if you want to get some more information and updates, go to odetobillyjoe333.com. And certainly join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We have a Facebook comment from Monica. She says, Sinead O'Connor's version of Ode is the best cover. Let's give it a listen. Sinead O'Connor's 1995 version of Ode to Billy Joe, featured on the charity compilation, The Help album, and Tara, very sort of dramatic and kind of spare.
Oh, yeah, that's a pretty raunchy version, yeah. I've never noticed before, but I think that the drum is the drum sample from Lou Donaldson's 1967 version, which is one of the most sampled in hip hop.
Oh, so interesting.
You find Lou Donaldson's Ode to Billy Joe on Kanye West tracks and all that stuff. But I think that's it. But yeah, I mean, Sinead knows how to bring some pain, right?
She sure does. But what's and going back even to the lyrics, and you said to what Bobby Gentry said about the lyrics, it's less about what they threw off the bridge, although that has intrigued people for many years now. But it's about the indifference of the parents, right? The fathers, you know, saying this guy wasn't going to amount to anything anyway, and the mom as well.
Yeah, she said it. She used some different phrases over the years to say the same thing over and over and over when being asked so many times. But she often said it was a study in unconscious cruelty. Mm. And she said it wasn't even protesting the unconscious cruelty. She said, I don't know if it'd necessarily be a good thing if you had so much empathy for everyone all the time. But it was, you know, kind of a comment on empathy and the, again, the sort of impossibility of it. And particularly, she focused on the South, and that's what made her, quote, a country singer, which right. I sort of take issue with. But she wrote about country themes, you know. I mean, her compositions are much more elaborate pop compositions, but her content is looking at the very, what she called the peculiar way that the South, people in the South, processed tragedy and birth and death. And that the conventions like supper time that are meant supposedly to bring, you know, tighten a family can also be wielded to drive people apart.
You see some parallels to Eudora Welty or perhaps, a very Southern writer and an amazing storyteller, too.
Yeah, I was reading some Eudora Welty short stories throughout, you know, while I was working on this, and it struck me. It's always, you know, typically her lyrics were compared to William Faulkner and, you know, Southern Gothic, and I agree with all that, but I couldn't help but notice how much it had in common with some of Eudora Welty's points of view, too.
You include a stanza that was never recorded. I'll just read it here. People don't see Sally Jane in town anymore. There's a lot of speculating. She's not acting like she did before. Some say she knows more than she's willing to tell, but she stays quiet and few think it's just as well. No one really knows what went on Choctaw Ridge the day that Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the included in the archives at Ole Miss, where she dedicated her papers. What's so fascinating about that is that originally it's not from her point of view. It's not from the singer's point of view. So she names the character. It's Sally Jane Ellison. And by chopping that stanza out, it allowed her to inhabit the character. And in some ways, I believe that caused her to be sort of caged into that Ode to Billy Joe persona, which her work obviously transcended. She continued to evolve and performed less and less, quote, regional material as she went along in her career. Her last record for Capitol is not, you wouldn't call it country by any stretch, Patchwork. It's much, like I say, it's more Dori Previn than Dolly Parton, for sure.
Interesting.
You know? But I think chopping that out and just allows people to imagine that this is a first-person commentary that she's making.
Which maybe makes it more powerful. I don't know. I mean, maybe, yes, it caged her in, but...
Oh, yeah, it's a double-edged sword. That's the whole thing. But particularly, I get into it a bit in there, but particularly female pop singers, it's expected that they're performing from the heart and not through these filtered layers of a persona and the character of the song.
We have a tweet from Patrick. Reading the book, I get the sense that Bobby Gentry is the Harper Lee of the music industry.
Interesting.
That's a very interesting comment.
Yeah. The Holly George Warren, who's done some writing on Bobby Gentry herself, has christened her the J.D. Salinger of rock and roll, which is irresistible.
Yeah. I mean, can we say she was a one-hit wonder? She took that, but she created an amazing career. Yes, short-lived, but career for herself.
Well, I think that's an unfair moniker because when you do listen to that inherent in that is the idea that it's the only that they only produced one hit that was worthwhile, you know, or even hit, you know. Fancy was a huge hit, and she was also bigger in England than she was in the United States. But if you want to measure dollars and cents, but if you actually take a full look at her full career, I think that's a pretty short-sighted analysis of her.
Well, I do want to play Fancy, but I do have to say I listened to all the songs on Ode to Billy Joe, and Mississippi Delta and some were interesting. There was a certain musical theme. I think a lot of musicians do this. Those are the ideas that they are interested in at the time, and it's clear she is. There's a certain kind of ways that stories or the songs move.
Yeah, she was playing a lot of Latin jazz before Ode, and she's interested in that, that sort of finger-picked vibe. And Nikki Hokie is the only cover on the song, but it goes in with, in vibe with all of that. She has a sound for sure.
For sure. Well, let's listen to Fancy, and this is by Bobby Gentry, and this was her second biggest hit. The song is from 1970 and was featured on the album of the same name. Let's give it a listen.
I remember it all very well. Looking back, it was the summer I turned 18. We lived in a one-room run-down shack on the outskirts of New Orleans. We didn't have money for food or rent, to say the least, we were hard-pressed. Then Mama spent every last penny we had to buy me a dancing dress. Mama washed and combed and curled my hair, and she painted my eyes and lips. And then I stepped into my satin dancing dress, it was split on the side, clean up to my hips. It was red velvet trim, and it fit me good. And staring back from the looking glass was a woman where a half-grown kid had stood. Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down. Here's your one chance, Fancy, don't let me down. Lord, forgive me for what I do, but if you want out, well, it's up to you. Now, don't let me down, your mama's gonna help you move uptown. Mama dabbed a little bit of perfume on my neck, and she kissed my cheek.
That was Bobby Gentry's second biggest hit, a song called Fancy. The song from 1970, featured on the album by the same name. And it's so funny, we've been talking for almost an hour now. I haven't talked about what a great voice she had.
She has a great voice, yeah. She didn't want to, like I said, she wanted to be the composer-songwriter, but she's the whole package.
Yeah. We have a comment from Art. He says, am I the only person who associated this song with Harper Valley PTA? Sounds like the same person is singing the song, and the tune of the two songs are extremely similar.
Well, yeah, Harper Valley is another story song about a woman. I think it's Tom T. Hall, and he wrote that he was inspired by Ode to Billy Joe.
Oh, interesting.
For sure.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's another song by Dolly called The Bridge that's pretty straight off Ode to Billy Joe, too. I mean, having that big of a hit, people are going to be inspired by it and replicate it. Fancy is funny because she spent all those years talking about how she did not write politics into her songs, and that Ode to Billy Joe was not a political statement on race or gender or anything. And then she relented and said, you know, okay, Fancy is my song, that's as political as I'm going to get, and that's my song for Woman's Lib if you really listen to it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. So what is she saying in the song?
Well, the song is about a girl whose mother turns her out to keep the baby from starving, you know, and then she goes and just be nice to the gentleman, Fancy, and they'll be nice to you, is the line. And then she's pouring tea in a Georgia mansion and defiant. She says, you know, and I ain't done bad. Whenever she says it in concert, she throws the bow over her shoulder, she says, and struts around, you know. I think that for Bobby Gentry, you know, it's always the age-old – what I'm really fascinated by, it's always the age-old question with feminism. She's saying this is a feminist anthem, and it's, you know, the question today is still, like I said, Beyonce, everybody has to, you know, go to the microphone and announce, you know, what they think, and if they could be feminist while catering to the male gaze and all that. And I think Bobby Gentry's answer in that song is if that's what – you know, you got to do what you got to do to gain your independence and – you know, that's her answer for that.
Well, you mentioned the fact that when
pretty
she was
aggressive.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty aggressive is right. I mean, she moved to California when she was 13 and lived with her mom, I guess her mom and stepfather.
Right.
But it sounds like she and her mom were performers together. Yes. Ruby?
Yeah, they were in the local country club, you know, not I don't think professional performers, but Ruby was a beautiful woman in her own right, played guitar. So they performed under Ruby's under the maiden name, under Myers. So it was Ruby and Bobby Myers at the local country club, and I found a little clip that they were, you know, local favorites at the country club.
I mean, two really beautiful women young woman and her mom.
Yeah. Yeah, so Ruby also drew, and Bobby was an artist. She painted. It's presumed that she painted the covers on Fancy and Patchwork. So it's just a very artistic family, who also you know were educated in the fine art of reinvention for themselves.
A very American thing.
A very
if
American
I might say
thing.
So myself.
Profoundly American. Mm-hmm.
I do want to play another song, and this is Ella Fitzgerald, and she's singing Ode to Billy Joe. And this is during a television appearance, and she's seen alongside Frank Sinatra. We don't hear Frank Sinatra, but this has a very spontaneous feel to it. Let's give it a listen.
I know the one you mean. Oh, yeah.
sleepy, dusty hurt day. I was out on Choctaw Ridge. My brother Bill was bailing hay. Today, Billy Joe McAllister jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge.
Wow.
We're laughing, listening to Ella Fitzgerald's version of Ode to Billy Joe, kind of playing with the lyrics there.
Oh, yeah, literally. She almost got it.
She's very close. But again, it's and it'll be interesting to see, Matt, whether this song gets a continued, I guess, new life as people perhaps, you know, reading your book or whether this book kind of puts the song out into the public again, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, there seems to be a renaissance of interest in her work in general, you know, Ode to Billy Joe and beyond. It looks sort of ironic. I wrote about Ode to Billy Joe in part to argue that there's a lot more than Ode to Billy Joe, you know, using the album as a prism to look at her bigger career. But there, that writer I mentioned earlier Holly George Warren wrote an article in Mojo in 2003, I think, that really resuscitated a lot of interest, framed as the mystery girl and the J.D. Salinger of rock and roll and stuff. In the interim, a boutique label had reissued a lot of her catalog that wasn't available on digital. You know, people were just doing the vinyl hunt. And there's some more projects that I've heard about in the works. I've teamed up with a documentary filmmaker, Ruth Lightman, who is Philly roots, but she's in Chicago, directed Lipstick and Dynamite and Wildwood, New Jersey, some of my favorite documentaries. And we're looking at that, you know, hoping to make that happen.
Wow.
Well, I found so much Vegas, never seen Vegas footage and things in my research that it's really a visual story. But we're hoping Bobby will lead on that project.
Or maybe even talk to
we'll
you.
See.
Who
we'll
knows?
See.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's something, we're almost out of time here, but reading your book and even your sort of hunt talking to people, there seems to be something kind of unknowable about her. Would you say that?
I would, yeah. She's just so, and that's the thing. It's sort of I see her as sort of a Robert Johnson figure that you could sort of do a deep dive and illuminate these caverns that haven't been seen before. And certainly because she left the spotlight over the last 30 years, the Vegas stuff all but disappeared from the popular consciousness. Her 10 years before Ode, you know, disappeared. But I mean, I don't know what I would kill to talk to her.
I bet you would.
And, you know, I feel like I illuminated a lot of things, that haven't been written about before, but I don't feel like I know. Of course I don't know, you know, but I, she's such a creative person and so dynamic and was so nonstop that whatever her reason for stepping out of the spotlight, I don't believe that she stopped creating things. So maybe we'll see an autobiography or a new album or something.
Well, on that note, Tara Murtha, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And the book is called Ode to Billy Joe, part of the 33 and a third record book series, I should say. And for more information and just to keep track of this elusive singer-songwriter, Ode to Billy Joe, 333.com. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. And you can go to iTunes to download a podcast of the show. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.